Hello, and welcome to the Life of Wiley podcast with me, Ian Wiley. Today, Downton Abbey. ITV1's Sunday night period drama has proved a big hit, with weekly ratings of up to 12 million viewers. Now, a second series of 8 episodes has been commissioned for broadcast in 2011. Written and created by Oscar-winning writer Julian Fellowes, Downton Abbey is set in an Edwardian country house in 1912 and portrays life both upstairs and down. In this podcast, you'll hear from Julian and executive producer Gareth Neame, as well as members of the cast, including Hugh Bonneville, Elizabeth McGovern, Jim Carter, Rob James Collier, and Joanne Froggatt. They talk about the making of the first series and the characters millions have grown to love, and in some cases, hate. First, Julian, who reflects on a very different time, almost 100 years ago.
I think it was a less angry world. Our politicians now make a great play of constantly encouraging a kind of class warfare because they think it pays off for them. And maybe it does. But I don't know how constructive it is in a society to constantly encourage one half of it to dislike the other half. And I think that was a slightly less angry world. But of course, it was all coming in the wings. I mean, one of the reasons why we went for 1912 is, you know, it was the dawn of trade unionism, it was the dawn of the Labour Party, it was not just electricity and aeroplanes and the obvious things. Enormous chunks of the modern world were coming, but I suppose we would all probably like to live in a less angry world, really. I was always rather interested in this way of life because, I was born in 49, and so it had finally sort of died in about 39. I mean, not, you know, still people with bucklers, but, I mean, as a kind of structure that went from Land's End to John O'Groats, it had kind of died. But very recently. And so when I was young, there were lots of people around, older people, who had lived this life until the Second World War. And it seemed so extraordinary to me that people could all be living under one roof with such entirely different expectations of life, such entirely different ambitions, and kind of rub along together. But living, they might as well have been on different planets. And so when I was asked to do Gosford, it wasn't that I had to get interested in that way of life. It actually, where I was extremely lucky, was my lucky break, which Gosford undoubtedly was, tapped into an interest that was already there. And I did, when Gareth came up to me, as we said, you know, and said, do you feel you can sort of revisit this? Of course, in writing Gosford, because it's whatever it is, 120 minutes or something, there's lots of things you feel you can't quite follow through within that format, although I love the movie, I think it's great. But this offered the opportunity to kind of go on with seeing these different parallel universes and the structures above and below and so on and so forth, that it was rather tempting. You know, as I think Evelyn Waugh said, novelists don't make much up. And on the whole, you pick at other people's lives for these characters and situations. There is a situation that I know of where the heir was a very distant relation and was brought to live on the estate. So I suppose you could say that was the sort of original mainspring of it. But, and you know, he came as a kind of outsider. And this guy, Dan Stevens's character, Matthew Crawley, is an outsider, although not, he's not a foreigner, but he is from a different world. And, you know, that creates lots of kind of jangling and jeopardy, you know, and everyone having to get used to everyone else and all of that. So it seemed a good basis. I think that that phenomenon of the buccaneers, I mean, what people don't perhaps realise, that something like 350 American heiresses married into the peerage in a comparatively short space of time. And the famous ones are the Duchess of Roxburgh and the Duchess of Marlborough and the Countess of Craven and all these. But they formed a sort of group within that group. And what I think in popular culture, we're aware of the American heiress, but what we don't think of is what happened to those women 30 years down the line of living this essentially alien life. I mean, they were not in Newport and married to a dry goods millionaire, which what would have happened to them if they'd stayed. They were locked into this different system, and I thought it was fun to kind of explore that, really. Well, you know, it's the third thing I've done with Maggie. And, I mean, of course, you know, when you write, in any way when you write, or I write, I tend to cast it in my head whether or not people play the parts, because it helps you give people different voices. Otherwise, the danger is everyone talks with the same voice. And I do imagine Maggie playing these parts. I mean, of course, if she hadn't played it, I would now be lying and saying that whoever had was my first choice. But in fact, she is my first choice because she just has that extraordinary quality of being very caustic and very tough and yet remaining kind of witty and a sense of a kind of inner good heart, which is a very tricky performance to bring off, actually. And yet she does it wonderfully. And so, yes, I do write specifically for Maggie.
Elizabeth McGovern, who plays Cora, Countess of Grantham, talked about her research for the role and filming on location at Highclere Castle near Newbury. You'll also hear from Hugh Bonneville, who plays her husband, Robert, Earl of Grantham, and more from Julian.
I had a fun time reading The Buccaneers. That was my research. Because really I'm an Edith Wharton buccaneer, all grown up and settled into the life they were all looking for. And I'm just pleased that Julian gave us a happy end, more or less, to the story of the rich American looking for the aristocratic name to put her fortune behind. It really was like going into another world. And I would come back from a couple of days and be forced by my kids to go to Westfield or someplace like that and be in a complete state of shell shock. It was and there's something to be said for a life without Wi-Fi interference in your brain the whole day, I'm telling you, because it was very peaceful.
I have to say, particularly during the volcanic ash period, and we were filming, and it so happened, as you have seen, that every time we filmed outside, nearly every single time, we had fantastic weather. And there was that week of the volcanic ash where there was no flies, you know, no air, no planes in the sky. And the silence and the clarity of the sky and the beauty of that place, it did literally, you know, you felt you were transported back into an era before bloody aeroplanes. And you realised quite how magnificent a time that was for anyone, wherever in the country, to have that, as you say, the lack of Wi-Fi and the simplicity of life, and also with that place, just the sheer grandeur. And it's a credit to our wonderful design that you don't realise that there are quite a few sets, actually. but no, we shot the principal rooms, obviously, are at Highclere. And what I love about the house is that it is a house. It is a castle, but it's not, you know, it's not crazily huge. It feels like a home when you're in it. And I think that adds, because Downton is such a vivid character in the show, and I think that really comes across. It feels like a working home rather than a labyrinthine castle.
It is. It was designed to sort of look bigger than it is, wasn't it, really? Because when you get in, it's actually quite taut. You've got one wing, but the bedrooms and the drawing rooms are all around that great hall. And it feels, I hesitate to say domestic, but it isn't quite as enormous as it looks on the screen. What was very good for us was that Carnival sort of bit the bullet and allowed us to shoot all the principal rooms that are the rooms of Hyde, that wonderful library, the drawing room, the dining room, and so on. Because the temptation is always to shoot the exteriors and then get everyone nearer London, so you get away from overnights and all that. And they didn't do that. The two sections that are sets, interestingingly, exactly the same as Gosford, because they're so changed in these houses, are the kitchens and the attics. The kitchens have always been made into something much more modern, and the attics have either been converted into flats or they're deserted. And either way, it is easier to build those. But the principal rooms, apart from one pretty significant bedroom, were pretty well all there, weren't they?
I think what makes any great show work is how people in a group manage to keep life moving. And to me, I can speak to what's fascinating to me when I see it. It's these people in a situation of great intimacy. I mean, again and again and again, you'll find the servants and the upper classes interacting with each other in ways in which their deepest, darkest inner selves are exposed, and yet there's this rigid structure that keeps it all going. And for me, that is what makes it fascinating. And Julian has this brilliant way of keeping the lines breaking down and then putting them back up and breaking down, and watching these people who are so intimately connected and yet so far apart at the same time.
Jim Carter plays butler Mr. Carson. He told the London Press launch how he would have fared in the job.
I'd be all right. I quite enjoyed life when it was structured, and the only time my life's been structured was when I was at school, but I didn't mind that at all. The life of an actor is completely unstructured. But I think I would have been quite good at it. I don't know. I might have invented a running buffet a little bit earlier. pouring port for these posh buckers at a dinner party wears a bit thin, I have to say. You know, and I did hope it wasn't just going to be sort of silver platters and bow ties all the time, and it proved not to be. So, you know, it was plenty to get your teeth into, which made it a great job, plus the fact, of course, there was such nice people to go to work with.
Rob James Collier plays Thomas, the first footman. I asked him about getting the role, playing a baddie, and moving on from his high-profile part as Liam in Coronation Street.
What was your reaction when you first got the script for this, Rob? What did you think?
Wow. It was a dream job. I've always wanted to play a gay Edwardian footman. every actor wants that job. No, it's just fantastic. The cast, Julian Fellowes, you just see them. You know, Dame Maggie Smith and Julian Fellowes, you see that in the email and you think, it's a no-brainer, really. Yeah. So it was fantastic to even audition for it, even greater when they asked me to become a part of it. It was brilliant. I loved it because every actor will love to play a bad guy, because I generally think, you know, you can have a lot more fun with him and you can try and bring a lot more sort of light and shade. But for me, I hadn't played anyone with particular malice. Not really, anyway, that before, so it was a new opportunity for me to try and do something different and show a new side to my acting. And I hope I've achieved that. We'll have to see as the series goes on. But he's always great. So I think it's better to play a bad guy than a nice guy. Because you can say all the things you want to say in life, but you're too scared to say. You can say it on the screen, it's all right, it's been written.
How did you approach your time after leaving Coronation Street? Because obviously you wanted to distance yourself from the part. Was the time period to getting this role about what you thought you'd have to do?
I knew that I'd have to wait, because you get offered a lot of work, but it's whether it's the kind of work you want to do. You know, there's two paths you can go. You can go down one route, which is more sort of about celebrity and exposure, or you can go down the route, which is what I am, a jobbing actor and focus on the acting side. I knew it was going to be a long while, because coming out as something, Coronation Street, it's a massive show, it's got a massive following and it's on 5 nights a week. So to come away from that vehicle, you've got to make your choices carefully, and you've got to be willing not to work. And I knew that it was going to be a long stretch before casting directors and people could look at you and not see, you know, who I played before. So I waited a long time. I waited as long as it takes, but I made precaution. I never thought I was going to walk out and straight into something. I knew it was going to be quite a long stretch, and I was willing to take that.
And you couldn't get anything much different, could you, in this role? I mean, it's a real contrast.
That's what I mean. And when it came along, it was just... That's why I say it's a dream job, because it's completely the other side of the spectrum. Particularly as it carries on, I think Julian got a handle what he saw from what we could do in the first series and then first episode, and then he started changing slight things later on. Definitely tweaked my character and made him nastier anyway, so, yeah.
Joanne Froggatt told me about her character, head housemaid Anna.
She's very sweet, really. She's very kind-hearted, and her stories develop very much over the series, or they're kind of a slow build towards the middle and end of the series, because she's a real support for a lot of people within the house, and she's a go-between the kind of junior staff and the senior staff. But also she's got a really good relationship with the daughters of the house, because she's their lady's maid as well, so she gets involved in storylines upstairs and downstairs, so she knows quite a lot of people's secrets, but she keeps them, you know, she keeps them to herself. Yeah, exactly. I think, I mean, for her age as well, she got to a very a great point in her career, really, to be head housemaid at kind of like mid to late 20s. There wasn't any choice, really, for a working class girl of that era. You know, it was either, especially in a rural area, it was either, you know, do marry and be at home with the children, or work on the farm with the family or something like that, or the best, you know, your best choice at that time was to go into service. And it was a chance to travel, which, you know, people didn't do. You know, you were born and bred in your little village and that's where you stayed. So it was a chance to meet different people. A lot of women joined service to kind of meet their match, really. A lot of women just thought it's a good way to meet a widest section of the community in terms of men and try and find a husband. So Anna's not got those ambitions, though. That's not her ambition for joining. I think she's just genuinely a quite intelligent girl, but she's happy with her lot. She knows her place, as it were. She knows she probably won't she won't aspire to be anything much more than she is. And but she's in a pretty good place, and I think she's quite grateful for where she is. So I think my grandma said to me, she's passed away now, but she said, well, you know, it's very hard nowadays because you have so many choices, you don't know where to go. And I just think I'd much rather have the choices. I'd hate to have to say I can only have my career or I can only get married. I can't think of anything worse. I love my career, and I really have aspirations, you know, personally and, you know, career-wise as well. So I'd have hated it. But then I suppose at the time you don't know any different. So if you'd grown up in that era and, you know, that was your upbringing, then I suppose the choices aren't there, so you just accept your lot, I suppose, at the time. But but looking back now, with all the things we can possibly do in our lives, then it seems a bit barbaric.
Hugh and Julian discussed working with the Downton Abbey etiquette expert.
We had this genius on set called Alistair Bruce, who is... what's his proper title?
No, Alistair Bruce of Creernich.
Of Creernich. And what's his role at the College of Arms? He's got some...
He's one of the heralds, but I can't remember which one.
Basically, he says his day job is to make sure that at the next coronation everyone sits in the right place. And there is nothing he doesn't know about the structure of that society, and he and Julian could be locked in a room for several days and never get bored talking about it, I know.
Although I'd always defer to Alistair, I have to say. If ever there was something I wasn't sure about, he always knew.
Yeah.
So he's a superior authority.
But there were details. I mean, I think what sets this show, as indeed Gosford Park, apart from other shows of its kind, is the attention to detail and the sense of authenticity, down to the extent of, when wearing tails, you don't flick your tails to sit down, as one sees concert pianists do, because your valet will iron them for you. So you just sit. And you certainly don't put your hands in your pockets at any stage. And there was one shot when Alistair was away, and my hand snuck into my pocket, and there was sort of calls for a reshoot, because... but I think it actually stayed in. It was so dark, that scene, you can actually see my hand in my pocket, but it's there. And Alistair was mortified the next day when he saw the rushes. So from then on, I had my trousers pocket sewn up.
The last word goes to executive producer Gareth on the magic of Downton.
Most period drama on television, 99% of it is adaptations of novels, and we set out to make a new original piece of work where it didn't feel like most costume dramas do that. You know, there's that journey the audience goes into immersing yourself in a wonderful sort of different world and a different land. We didn't want to do that with this show. We wanted to feel like the audience could feel they were part of this house, that they were one of the servants, or imagine what it would be like if you worked as a maid, or if you were lucky enough to be a member of the family. So we wanted it to have a much more contemporary here and now feeling to it. And also, it was very important that all of these 18 characters are as important as each other. And in most period dramas you see, it is really only the lord and lady or the daughters or whatever, or the children that matters. And footmen tend to be flunkies with gloves on who open doors. And there was a certain amount of sort of re-education of all of the team involved, that in this show, if you were a second footman or you were Daisy, you're as important a character and you have as much drama to do as the heads of the family. So there was always, I think, a democratic sense both in the narrative and in the storytelling, and therefore how we actually approach the production. It's a real skill that Julian's demonstrated with a cast of 18 characters. And, you know, I often work on series where you have half that number of actors, and after you've done a few episodes, they're all coming up to you saying, you know, I haven't got enough to do, or I've got too much to do. You know, I'm working too many days, or I haven't got enough story. And I get the sense that all 18 of the actors felt that they could see every single character has a story that's being weaved and a journey to go on. And I think that's an immense skill, that it's okay to see it in the first episode, but to keep that going over many, many episodes, to keep spinning all these plates, as we say, is a real skill. And I think it's what's made it a very happy experience making the production.
And that's all from Downton Abbey. There's more on all things TV at lifeofwiley.com. So until next time, thank you for listening and goodbye.